Hi, and welcome to Outlaw, a podcast about how the law is used to repress social movements in the U.S. I'm your host, Olive, and today I'm talking to anti-fascist data researcher and terrorism studies scholar Michael Lodenthal about, well, terrorism. These days, it seems like just about anything can make you a terrorist. Sleeping in a tent on your university's lawn, attending a music festival in the Wilani Forest, or setting a cop car on fire. So what's up with terrorism? To answer this question, I'm going to talk with Michael about the recent history of the strategy for chilling dissent, and how it fits into the current landscape of repression. Stay tuned after the interview for a related update on the past year of repression against the movement to stop Cop City. If you like the show, you can support us by telling your friends and following us on Blue Sky at Outlaw Pod. This podcast is not legal advice, nor is it an endorsement of any particular kind of action. I'm excited to welcome Michael Lodenthal onto Outlaw. Michael, to start, could you introduce yourself and share a little bit about your research on the state's repression of social movements?
Sure. So my name is Michael Lodenthal, and I use he, him pronouns. So I am based at the University of Cincinnati, where I've been for the last few years. And my work is largely based on active ethnography and document analysis. So what I really try to do is to excavate some of these leaked and otherwise found documents and to use them to determine kind of how the state is operating from behind closed doors. So it's a big part of what I do. I also really focus on data-driven analysis. So I run a research center, an all-volunteer research center called the Prosecution Project. And we work to kind of excavate some of these court records to use them to understand how the state operates in terms of prosecuting political dissent and other forms of political violence. I really believe in the sort of intellectual tradition of people like C. Wright Mills, who have argued, somewhat controversially, that the purpose of studying society, the purpose of understanding society, is to change it. I realize that there are some people who believe that knowledge production is sort of a neutral endeavor. I think that's like not only dishonest, but it's not desirable. And so I sort of lean into the fact that our work needs to be very, very empirical, very, very provable, demonstrable, and it's not just take my word for it, but that it should have an agenda. And the agenda is making society better and improving and uplifting large parts of society. The other thing I'll say is that because my work is focused on social movements and affected communities, I really work hard to make the work non-extractive. Like I'm not, parachuting into a community that's not mine, sort of taking its stories and knowledge and writing about it. I generally work within the communities in which I research, and I have for decades. And I've worked amongst these communities, both in counter repression and in training people for security for now at this point 20 years. And so I really try to make that a part of the research I'm doing. So I try to produce research that is useful to my community, and to do that in a way that's non-extractive, which is not particularly simple.
So speaking broadly, why is the framework of terrorism helpful for the state? What are some of the things it achieves?
Sure. So the framework for terrorism has been used, for hundreds of years in a sense. And what it largely is used for is to establish discursive powers, to establish the power of discourse, and to defame one's enemies. Without much nuance, we can say overall that terrorism is a label used by the powerful to kind of describe those who lack power, or those who are marginalized. And, there's just a lot of historical examples of this. From the well-captured ones, like the Battle of Algiers, as captured in the film, The Battle of Algiers, to maybe less well-studied ones, in the contemporary, where some of the kind of activism and terrorism lines are blurred. So generally, it's used as a term to kind of defame one's enemies. And I think its function is to kind of inscribe interpretive narrative atop of political actions. In other words, by calling someone or someone a terrorist, or by calling something terrorism, the speaker is hoping to proactively interpret those actions and that individual for you. They're trying to tell you, this is how you should understand this form of dissent. And as you're probably aware, there's a number of pre-existing political violence discourses that you're already well familiar with. So, we have ones like Outside Agitator, which has, anti-Semitic and anti-Black histories and things like that. We have the one which was really common in the anti-globalization era, the so-called entitled activist, the idea that activists are just like bored, rich, trust fund kids that want something to do. There's also the notion of professional protester. This came up a lot in the Gaza encampments. But these sort of narratives, right, outside agitator, entitled activist, professional protester, are meant to inscribe a certain interpretive logic on top of otherwise, difficult to interpret and diverse political actions. So these are the kind of tropes that are used to defame movements. And through defaming and mischaracterizing movements, we're able to kind of defang them and coordinate their repression through not just hard forms of repression, like, beatings and arrests, but through discursive repression and ideological forms of countering.
Yeah, could you say a little bit more? I know you said discourse and discursive. Could you just, in even more simple terms, explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so a discourse is sort of how we decide the limits of a conversation. So we know when we say, what is the discourse on patriotism? There are certain things we can talk about while talking about patriotism. So the kind of discursive boundaries or the boundaries set by the discourse say what is and is not included in that discussion of a particular topic. So, the ways in which the state uses discourse is a huge topic. But generally, it's used in a way to provide explanatory framework for things. So, in other words, we are taught to think about certain topics in certain ways. So, the discourse on patriotism is set for us, right? What idea you can accept or what position you can accept within that discourse is limited by the discourse itself. In other words, by establishing these realities, we can kind of pen the range of a particular conversation and say that things outside of that range are thus not valid. So the discourse says which ideas and which notions are kind of valid within a larger conversation.
So by, using terrorism to describe activists or any marginalized community, it's setting the bounds of the conversation. It's
That's exactly
defining
right.
how we can look at them.
Yep,
Totally.
that's exactly right.
So to understand how the state has weaponized this label of terrorism, I want to start at 9/11, which you've written a lot about as a key moment. What was the significance of the state's response to 9/11 for social movements, specifically in terms of state repression?
Yeah. So 9/11 was a watershed moment in a lot of ways. When 9/11 occurred, the anti-globalization movement or what was, called the anti-globalization movement was really at its height. So just to rewind a little bit, right? People probably recall the 1999, the November 1999 so-called battle in Seattle. This is an event in which, 40 to 60,000, demonstrators shut down the meetings of the World Trade Organization that were being held in Seattle, Washington. And at least to the media and a number of other kind of talking heads, people were shocked by it. They were really caught off guard. And this sort of represents a sort of a high watermark in the anti-globalization movement, which we could say runs from about 1997 to about 9/11. During this time, every meeting of international financial groups was a large site of protest. So every meeting of the World Bank, the meetings of the International Monetary Fund, which occurred, in DC in the fall and spring, the meetings of the G8 and the G20, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So whenever these groups would meet, to say nothing of presidential inaugurations and other sorts of things, there was, a groundswell of activity, tens of thousands of people. It was not a challenge in, let's say, 2000 to get 40,000 people to demonstrate against the World Bank. And then when 9/11 happened, it really derailed that in a pretty severe way. In part, the fall ministerials, the fall meetings of the IMF and the World Bank were to occur a few weeks later. If memory serves, it was the 29th of September that they were, because these things are kind of dated in activist parlance, and I believe it was S29, but sometime around the end of September was meant to be the fall meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. So a number of groups in the DC area, most notably the Anti-Capitalist Convergence and the Mobilization for Global Justice, which sort of represent the like anarchist side through the ACC and the sort of libertarian socialist, but not explicitly anarchist side through Mobilization for Global Justice. These groups had mobilizations planned. You know, they had planned to welcome tens of thousands of people. And then 9/11 happened. And I think that represented a lot for people, because what that meant is that when September 29th rolled around and the demonstrations occurred, basically everyone but the anarchists pulled out. So, you know, during that mobilization, there were, you know, I would say hundreds of people, probably in the low thousands, represented by the ACC. But I think that was a moment where myself and lots of other organizers looked around and we said, this is different, right? People are afraid to be called terrorists. People are afraid to show dissent, because by showing dissent in a very unnuanced way, they're kind of lumped into this other category. So the demonstrations in September of 2001, you know, were really just, you know, very, 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 very marginalized, or marginal rather, compared to the other demonstrations that had happened prior. So I think when that happened, a lot of us looked around and we said, this isn't going to work anymore, right? People are not going to come by that, by the droves, if they're going to be called terrorists. And so this was kind of a start, but not the highest point of this kind of state's terrorization, what I would call terrorization rhetoric, a rhetoric where any form of dissent or many forms of dissent were described as terrorism, right? That kind of began in the 9/11 era. And, you know, it arguably started before then. So if we look at some of the FBI annual reports that came out in like 1998 and 1999 and 2000, we'll see the elevation of specifically animal and environmental demonstrators, you know, so-called animal liberationists and eco-liberationists. So if you want a sort of proper noun, you can think of the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, but we really mean a more broadly defined social movement. Starting in around 1998, 1999, these groups were described by the FBI as, you know, domestic terrorists. And, you know, in a number of well-chronicled comments, they were described as the number one domestic terrorist threat. Again, when 9/11 happened, that sort of felt kind of ludicrous, even though there were some politicians who sort of used that number one domestic terrorist label even after the death of nearly 3,000 people. Now, mind you, the animal and earth liberation movement, having existed, you know, globally since the 1970s and in the United States since a little bit after, has, you know, no blood on its hands in that sense. There are no histories of that movement going after people and murdering people, or, you know, putting bombs in civilian sites or even in non-civilian sites. You know, again, without going down a rabbit hole, there are some people who will quickly kind of throw the so-called Unabomber case, the Ted Kaczynski case in there. But anyone who looks into that with any degree of specificity sees that that's well outside of this movement whatsoever. And actually, Kaczynski was very against these movements and certainly not a part of them. But anyway, you know, throughout this sort of 30-year history, when the animal and earth liberation movement exists, it's not doing what we would typically regard as terrorism. It's not hijacking planes, not blowing up buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in the late 1990s, when these groups started to be described as terroristic, people were somewhat suspicious. And then when 9/11 happened and people continued to describe both Salafi jihadis terrorism and animal, you know, and earth liberation groups in the same vein, I think that felt false to a lot of people. And so seeing these the images of these sort of things, you know, co-occur on federal publications, I think was pretty bizarre. And again, those are sort of some specific examples, but there's lots of things we could point to. We could point to Operation Backfire, which is the FBI operation, which kind of came down in 2005 against members of the Animal and Earth Liberation Front. This is, you know, following the well kind of known arson in Vail, Colorado, and a number of other large scale arsons. So that was in 2005. A couple years later, in 2008, we have the passage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which we can go back to and talk about. But again, that represents sort of a line that was crossed. So, you know, to say that anyone who breaks the law in the name of animal rights is thus committing an act of terrorism is a very specific, again, kind of discursive line to draw. And so that's in 2008. And that was sort of a reissuing of a previous law called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And then it was, you know, renamed into the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Again, the other example that, you know, if folks want to look into this more is the 2007 prosecution of the RNC 8, the so-called RNC 8. These are eight activists who were charged for disrupting the Minneapolis Republican National Convention. And again, were held under state domestic terrorism and Patriot Act statutes. And so these are, you know, really interesting to have nonviolent demonstrators charged under, you know, laws assumingly set up for national security purposes. So 9/11 had a number of kind of cumulative effects. One is that it took a lot of activists sort of out of the game because they didn't want to be confused with, like, you know, quote unquote, those scary terrorists. And so people kind of ran away from dissent and ran away from clandestine dissent because they didn't want to be lumped in with Al Qaeda and the Taliban, et cetera. But it also allowed politicians and political elites to sort of craft laws to say, look, we need laws to protect you from, you know, buildings falling and scary people and airplanes and things like that. And so the kind of damage of 9/11 and the, you know, the lethality of 9/11 was exploited and weaponized against domestic political movements, to say nothing of the way it was weaponized against Arab and Muslim and South Asian cultures, which is a separate topic and deserving of its own study. But here what I really mean is how the policing of one movement that's, you know, certainly not a leftist movement, was sort of exported onto the left and arguably you know, it continues to be utilized in the same way to this day.
Yeah. Can you say more about that when you say continues to be utilized in this way to this day?
Yeah, I can. It's sort of a tricky era to study political violence. You know, it's now March of 2025. You know, for those who are listening to this in close to when we recorded it, you know, every day under the new administration, there are sort of new examples to point to. You know, today on my ride in to work, you know, the big discussion is a U.S. green card holder who is now facing deportation and a revoking of his citizenship for his role in the Gaza encampment protests of last spring. Things like that, I think, would not have been possible without the kind of discursive shift which happened after 9/11. The idea that those in dissent are therefore un-American, or those in dissent are therefore not part of the national community or not deserving of citizenship, is a thing I don't believe we would have been able to push without 9/11. You know, when you have responsive policy, you know, responsive policing policy, you need a boogeyman. You need something to point to say, if you don't do this, this scary thing will happen. And you know, 9/11 provided that. You know, arguably the October 7th attacks in southern Israel have provided that in a different way. Arguably, some of the far right movements that have happened since 2017 have provided some of these examples. And so the realities that were established in 2001, the idea that dissent against the nation state is a form of terrorism, or can be a form of terrorism, is something that we certainly see now. And again, you know, without going into kind of a larger thesis, you know, what I've argued in the past is that this has sort of occurred in epochs, you could say, that, you know, between the late 1990s and the early 2000s, we have this era where, you know, everything is kind of terrorism. So again, it kind of starts with the Animal and Earth Liberation Front and the so-called Green Scare. And then it obviously, you know, reaches this apex in 9/11. And then it sort of tapers because, you know, there are other things that come up. Again, it before tapering, it's, you know, really used against, for example, Somali communities in their equation for equating them to members of Al-Shabaab and South Asian communities, equating them to supporters of the Taliban. And there's all sorts of ways. And that's what I would argue kind of we're seeing right now, you know, the equating of, you know, Palestinian demonstrators or pro-Palestinian demonstrators to terrorist supporters. So we kind of see this in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then the early 2000s, for whatever reason, you know, after 9/11, we see that some of that terrorist labeling declines. And what we see is an increase in another form of defamation, which is people who commit crimes are charged as felons. In other words, misdemeanor crimes are kind of recast as felonies. And there's a whole litany of state laws, which we could point to, which we see happen here, largely in response to the Black Lives Matter movement, the campaign against the Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock, the campaign against the Mountain Valley Pipeline, some immigration work in the South, for example, the campaigns against No Mas Muertes and other groups like that. And then 10, 15 years into that, we see the state shift again and start calling everyone rioters. So, we could say it's a period of riotization. So we kind of have this period where everyone's terrorists. That's kind of in the early or late 90s. And then we have this period sort of in the middle where everyone's a felon. And then, by the kind of reemergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, 2016, 2017, everyone's a rioter. And that's sort of, what we saw is kind of terrorist to felon to rioter. And again, in the new era, in this kind of 2025 era, I am guarded in making future predictions, but we're going to fit into, one, if not more, of these boxes again.
Oh my gosh, there's so much there. Even just thinking about that period of anti-globalization protest and followed by 9/11 and the shift from like domestic terrorism in the animal liberation movements to terrorism feels so parallel to even what we were seeing with the focus on Stop Cop City and domestic terrorism and then the October 7th Palestinian uprising and following genocide and the criminalization of Palestine protests, the shift to terrorism and focus on, the more global idea of a terrorist. Could you talk a little bit about how the state's image of the terrorist differs from that of the domestic terrorist and the role that race plays? I thought you provided a really interesting example in deconstructing terrorism about the image on the cover of a 2012 Joint Terrorism Task Force report that featured photos of Osama bin Laden, a masked Animal Liberation Front activist holding a liberated primate, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, a Hamas fighter, and the Tamil Tigers.
So there's a I don't have the image in front of me, so it's not super fresh, but yes, the way in which this reality is kind of cast generally follows heavily racialized and heavily ethnically linked patterns. So speaking in the broadest terms possible, and this is how I explain it to undergraduate students sometimes, because I think this is a useful frame to begin from, is that terrorism is understood as something they do to us, right? And they are like understood to be non-white and non-Christian and non-American, right? They are othered. That's the sociological word. So terrorism is something they do to us, and they are understood in this othered capacity, and us are understood as this kind of white, Christian Anglo-Saxon society, which obviously includes, not only does it not include me, but doesn't include most people in this society. So that's generally how it's understood, right? Sometimes if you look at literature on extremism, which is sort of the more domestic word used to describe the same actions, we're often talking about in-group and out-group. J.M. Berger's work, he had did a book a few years ago, I believe it's just called Extremism. But he does a good job explaining this, the kind of notion of inner community and outer community, in-group and out-group. This is what social movements sort of develop. But when we look at it in broad strokes, domestic terrorism, or what we sometimes often call extremism, is sort of something we do to us, whereas terrorism is a word that's kind of reserved for an external threat that sort of comes, into the cities. And so, what I think is really bizarre is combining these things in the same discussion. So this cover that you speak of that has traditional foreign terrorist organizations, and again, I'm trying to use the language which is like precise and accurate. Do I think that all of the organizations and networks included on the foreign terrorist organization list are equivalent and should gain the label of terrorists? No, I don't. But like that is what they are. They are the foreign terrorist organizations. So I'm not going to like continue to make air quotes because you can't see me. But I think that this language is important, but also extremely problematic. Anyway, my point is that almost every entity on the foreign terrorist organization list, which is a legal list of organizations maintained by the Department of State, you can look it up online right now. You just type in FTO list, Department of State, you will find it. Those organizations are understood as foreign. That is the legal basis for them. One of the confusion points in this country, which makes me want to just set fire to every TV I see, discussing this, is any discussion you hear about adding people or removing groups from the domestic terrorist list. You hear this conversation constantly, and it's a ludicrous conversation because there is no domestic terrorist list, at least in a public, open source, legal basis. Do I think the intelligence, officials in the U.S. government maintain lists of domestic organizations? Of course they do. But there's not a domestic terrorist designation list in the way that there is for foreign groups. In other words, you can only be considered on a legal basis a terrorist in this country or have committed an act of terrorism if you partner or do work for a foreign terrorist organization. There are no legal domestic terrorist organizations, therefore domestic terrorism as a sort of federal construct doesn't really exist. Now, again, that changes state by state. But generally, when we kind of talk about the way in which terrorism is cast, specifically in the law, terrorism is something done by non-white, non-Christian, non-Western entities to a white Christian American entity. And that's sort of the way it plays out. There are very, very rare exceptions to this. One of the kind of, I think it was a fuck you to the incoming administration, but one of the last actions of the Biden administration was to designate a far right group as a domestic terrorist organization. And I think that was extremely rare. And if you look at the list of FTOs, very, very few of them outside of the Russian Imperial Movement, fit into that category. And again, that demarcation is unique for the United States. So when you look at Canada, if you look at equivalent so-called Five Eyes countries, so Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of those countries do prescribe American-based or U.S.-based domestic entities as foreign actors. So groups like Adamoff and the Base, the Proud Boys, groups like this. But in the United States, those groups are not considered terrorist organizations. And just to be clear, I don't think they should be. I don't actually think that really helps anything to overuse that term. But other countries have different designations. So whereas in some other countries, terrorism can occur from a group of people that look like the domestic population. In the United States, that's really not the case. The United States, terrorism is done by people who are not us, to us.
Going back a little bit, you've quoted the ALF support magazine Bite Back, in which the authors explain the Green Scare as legal and extra-legal actions taken by the U.S. government against environmental and animal rights activists. Like the Red Scare, the Green Scare uses new laws and new arms of the state to harshly punish a few individuals in order to repress an entire movement. You write, the reactionary development of the Green Scare label coincided with the state's own invented language, an attempt to quantify and label their enemies under one banner, eco-terrorism, a term coined by the government in 2002. And talking about the stage that the Green Scare set and mm-hmm. the sort of new norms that were set then. Are there any, either ones that were part of Operation Backfire or other examples that you feel like are really important or maybe often overlooked in terms of both emerging at that time in connection with a terrorism framework or in important in how they're showing up today?
So, the Green Scare represents just a really interesting period. It sort of represents a time period in which the state shifts its focus a little bit. Again, there's a lot I've kind of written about here about this sort of state's attempt to change the way it polices. And again, I'll do the kind of very brief version of this. Largely through the work of people like Michel Foucault and other post-structuralists, there's this notion that power occurs in different ways. And again, this is a very truncated version of very complicated work. But largely what Foucault would say is that, there's different kind of eras of power, epochs of power. So there is sort of the power of the king, right? What we call monarchical power. So monarchical power is the idea that, like, when there is dissent, the king, like, brings you to the town square and chops off your head. And everyone sees that. And they're like, oh my God, I don't want to rise up against the king because I will get my head chopped off. And that's really bad. And so at a certain point, after enough heads have been chopped off, monarchical power becomes no longer necessary. So after enough people realize that if they dissent, they're going to end up, on the executioner block, then people start to self-discipline, or self-police, or simply not act up is the better idea, right? So if you're considering overthrowing the government or leading a peasant uprising, the moment that you're like, you know what? If I lead that peasant uprising, I'm probably going to be drawn and quartered. And then you decide not to lead that peasant uprising. That is an example of what Foucault called disciplinary power. So this is one of the things we see a lot in this era, is that the state uses monarchical power. In other words, they use naming and shaming. They use things like the FBI's most wanted list. They use these big public displays that defame people in the hopes that people will then self-police. And I think that has really worked, right? And that's something we kind of saw happening. So one of the reasons, you know, the FBI was so shouty about, you know, this person's a terrorist around 9/11, I think was that people would start to self-police. So again, if you look back at the most wanted terrorist list, now again, you'd have to use, you know, the Wayback Machine and things like that. But you know, spend a few minutes and do it. You know, find the URL for the most wanted terrorist webpage. I forget what the URL is, but put that into the Wayback Machine and look at it. Look at it in 2017. Look at it in 2012. Look at it in, you know, 2005. And you'll see a really interesting kind of pattern. You know, one of the things is that during the era of the Green Scare, you have individuals added to the most wanted terrorist list who, you know, don't belong there in a lot of senses. You know, there's that, I think it's on Sesame Street. It's like, which of these things is not like the other? You know, that's sort of the feeling I have. So again, I'll cite one example. Well after 9/11, we have, you know, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and a number of other, you know, very central players in that conspiracy added to the most wanted terrorist list. Now, again, debating whether or not bin Laden and Zawahiri are terrorists, I think it's a stupid debate. Did they want to kill Americans? Yeah. Did they want to like increase fear? Yeah. If that's what terrorism is, okay, throw them in that camp. But as I've already discussed, that's not really the purpose of labeling someone a terrorist. Anyway, in this kind of most wanted terrorist designation, we have Daniel Andreas San Diego, who at the time is added to that list. Daniel Andreas San Diego, who, as a side note, was just arrested like in the last couple months after 20 years on the run. You know, he allegedly orchestrated two bombings of property as part of the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign, the so-called SHAC campaign. But again, it's very different. So when you look at, you know, airplane hijacker, you know, person who blew up an airplane, or you look at someone who took over, you know, a housing complex in Saudi Arabia, you know, killing dozens of people. When you look at all those examples and then you see an American citizen who's killed and injured no one, it feels very odd. And so the function of this sort of monarchical power is to say, you know, if you dissent in the wrong way or at the wrong time, you're going to be put on blast in the same way as someone who killed 3,000 people, you know, and that is pretty important. You know, and again, there's so many kind of ways in which this is done. So in 2004, 2005, I believe, there was a series of congressional hearings. They're called something like Eco-Terrorism, Examining the Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front. And they're done from the Committee on Environmental and Public Works of the U.S. Senate. I think that was the 109th Congress, if memory serves. But a lot of those hearings are meant to, you know, to again, to take domestic dissent and to enter it, to insert it, to apply it to this national security label. And it's extremely effective in this time period. And again, there's a lot of ways in which disciplinary power kind of operates in the Green Scare through things like grand juries, you know, which is basically getting people to, in a sense, inform on their colleagues, and even if they don't, to assume that they did, to, you know, massive ubiquitous surveillance, you know, most notably revealed in part from the Edward Snowden leaks, but operating through the National Security Agency, as well as, you know, something I've written about a lot, which is the use of sexuality to infiltrate activist movements and the kind of distrust that that sows throughout. So there is this whole era where we see the state kind of recede from and then return to different forms of power, most notably monarchical power, and then this sort of disciplinary power where people are simply encouraged not to act. And this is definitely very visible in the Green Scare. You know, without naming specific cases, there's just a lot of examples. You know, there are state-level investigations which were done federally, you know, That's obviously a big thing. We see that a lot again in the 2020 protests, the George Floyd uprising. But we have things which could have been handled at the state level, but instead were prosecuted federally, which comes with a whole mess of resources. We have all of this increased cooperation between sort of state level agencies and federal agencies. So again, if you look at the Operation Backfire, for example, this is the arrest of the so-called family. This is the ELF and ALF affiliated cells who were, carrying out arsons and sabotage in the Pacific Northwest. But if you look at the evidentiary record behind that, you have dozens of police forces involved. State police forces, campus police forces, obviously FBI, ATF, Bureau of Land Management, all these different organizations working together and sharing. Again, to say nothing of private intelligence. We also have all these new laws which are introduced. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is just the best example of that. Because again, it says that, something that was arson in 1999 is now terrorism. So like the same physical act for the same physical reason, or the idea is that the motivation itself is what's criminalized, as well as kind of how crimes are investigated. So federal grand juries, ubiquitous surveillance, informants, all that sort of stuff sort of reaches a really high point in the Green Scare. And then again, sort of goes down a bit and then goes back up again in the sort of Dakota Access pipeline into Black Lives Matter era.
In hearing you talk about the agency collaboration and these different tactics of repression that showed up in the Green Scare that we're seeing today, it made me think about Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian activist from Colombia, who just yesterday, we're recording this on March 10th, was detained by DHS and is being threatened with deportation. And I'm curious how you situate this new tactic of targeting people with non-citizen status as a form of dissent repression follows with what we saw after 9/11, or is a departure from it?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's a very challenging thing to be asked to interpret history while it's happening, right? There's some sort of Howard Zinn quote about moving train in there, but I think that what we're seeing now is in a sense the new administration testing the water, and I think that the reaction to this is going to be really important. So, and again, I think a lot of organizations are doing this, right? Like I think the response by the ADL that was issued last night to wide condemnation is a good example of them testing the water to see how ideas will work or not. In other words, what I think we're seeing now is the new administration trying a tactic and saying we would like to kind of raise the cost to individuals for engaging in activism. And if there is a pushback to this, a large pushback from, everyday people that maybe will retreat from it. But if people kind of allow this to go forward, then it's something that they'll use again. And so I really think that this case is a test case. And I think that they were, the administration was smart enough to find a test case that they believed, that the administration believed would not garner very much support. Arguably the democratic loss, besides its own incompetence and total lack of perspective, is the way in which it responded very poorly to the Gaza war. And so I think with the 16, 17 months of defaming the Palestinian movement, that this is a really good test case for them, because I think from the new administration's perspective, the Palestinian movement and its supporters have been sufficiently demonized in a way that they're not a very sympathetic entity. So again, for anyone who remembers, the spring, I know it was a long time ago, it felt like it was years ago, but the idea that college campuses were no-go zones for Jewish students, again, is part of this discourse. Again, I'm Jewish. I work in the Jewish community. I'm very active in the Jewish community. I work on a college campus. I don't feel unsafe on these campuses. Do I think there is anti-Semitism? Of course there is. I don't think it's like the outsized problem that it's meant to be. My point is that I think one of the ways in which this is playing out is the administration really trying to draw a line and say, this is going to be our new response. This is going to be the way we're doing this. And again, there's a history of this, right? I mean, the Red Scare is the a really good example of this. So, 100 years ago, we have several different eras in the United States where, domestic leftist movements are policed in this way. So, you know, the idea of kind of deporting people or denying people citizenship privilege because they don't agree with you or because they're seen as un-American or their descent is not new whatsoever. It may be new, you know, it may be re-emergent, but it is not historically new whatsoever. And again, there's just a lot of examples of the kind of defamatory frameworks that have been used by previous administrations. Again, you know, 2018, during the first Trump administration, maybe is a really good time to look at this. You know, we have the H.R. 6054, the so-called Unmasking Antifa Act of 2018. That's like, you know, the sort of same kind of, you know, trying to other people. There's also a House Resolution 525 introduced as part of the 116th Congress that it's called like calling for the designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization. So we know there are a lot of attempts in the law to sort of legally other people, whether it's through citizenship, whether it's through saying that they're a member of a terrorist organization like Antifa, which, you know, with all the problematic taxonomy there, or whether it's, you know, what happened in the 1910s and 1930s of calling people communists and anarchists and deporting them to Russia and places like that. So I don't think it's new. I don't know if it's going to sustain. I think whether or not this sustains will be based on whether or not people get angry and whether or not people mobilize. And so if we remember the so-called Muslim travel bans of the first administration, that didn't work because people blocked airports and it was seen as untenable.
With the necessity of resistance in this moment to state repression strategies like these, what do you see as the weak points of a counterterrorism strategy for the state? Are there places where you think pressure could be applied effectively in resisting it?
I think to some degree, and this requires like a bit of a critical read, the state loses some credibility when everything is terrorism. You know, there are those of us, myself included, and lots of other people who have been personally affected by this. We've lost friends or relatives, colleagues, coworkers. I think for people who have a reference point in political violence that's personal, it's not only insulting to our intelligence, but it's morally reprehensible to call some things terrorism. That doesn't mean that people need to be personally affected to be bothered by it. But I think one of the weak points is the idea that everything is terrorism. We get to a certain point when even your average, you know, CNN watcher is like, you know what? No, that's not. Like wearing a keffiyeh and setting up a tent on a quad and linking arms and blocking entrance to an administrative building may be a lot of things, but it's not terrorism. It's not terror. It is not, you know, trying to communicate violence to secondary and tertiary audiences. And again, because it's the logical outgrowth of what I just said, you know, the general definition of terrorism is social or political violence, right? Violence with the socio-political agenda, violence which is seeking to kind of change the social political order, and which seeks to communicate to what we would call secondary or tertiary audiences. In other words, if you put a bomb in a movie theater, you know, a movie theater on an army base, let's say. That's meant to, you know, obviously injure those specific soldiers. It's meant to send a message to secondary audiences, that would be other US soldiers, or tertiary audiences, you know, third audiences, which would be like other people involved in the US military. You know, that's why acts of terrorism and political violence are done. That's why people often talk about political violence as communication or as a form of politics. That's different from other forms of symbolic dissent. One of the, I think, really frustrating things in the current administration that was really frustrating the last time they were in power is the very imprecise use of language. And again, I don't mean that just in an intellectual capacity. I really mean in a real way. You know, labeling anti-fascists as an organization is just a good, simple example of that. You know, saying that anti-fascists represent a domestic terrorist organization implies that they are an organization. You can't, you know, an ideology or a political framework is not an organization. I don't think anyone here is going to argue with that. But this sort of really imprecise use of language, I feel like is actually a weak point because it assumes that we, the audience to this play, don't understand what's going on, but we do, right? Like we look around, we have memories that are longer than 2 years. And a lot of us, you know, appreciate a precise use of language. So when everything is terrorism, you know, in a sense, nothing is terrorism. And so I think that that is one of the weak points in calling college activists Hamas supporters, in calling college activists terrorists. I think that's really problematic. And again, you know, again, it's a longer point, but I don't know why the administration is kind of centered on this notion of Hamas supporters the worst thing that people can be. Like, I think it's a very odd trope to kind of rely on. But you know, the idea that any sort of criticism of Israel or this war is somehow endorsement of wide-scale mass violence is so ludicrous that it really holds no water. So yes, do I think rhetoric like that sways some people? For sure. But I think it's actually a, you know, a chink in the armor, because I think for anyone who, you know, can read a sixth grade reading level, like anyone who can read the newspaper and kind of make sense of it, they see this, everyone is a terrorist, everyone is an anti-Semite. It's very, very thin, and they understand that it's used as a rhetorical act of defamation. So I actually think that the administration is shooting itself in the foot by just doing this more and more and more in this very kind of unnuanced way, because people see through it as rhetoric. People see through it as propaganda. I don't think that it provides us with a lot more leverage than that, but you know, if they really lean into this, then I think it's going to make them look kind of foolish.
Is there anything we didn't touch on that you feel is important for understanding how the state is using the framework of terrorism and domestic terrorism today and what we can do about it?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really useful is to kind of think about this in eras. And again, I kind of started to talk about that a little bit, but you know, I like to think of it at least in a 100-year span, from the Red Scare to COINTELPRO to the Green Scare to what we're currently talking about. And again, I can put dates on that, but you know, the Red Scare we're talking about, there's actually two Red Scares. So we're talking about the first Red Scare, which is around 1917 to 1920, the second Red Scare, which lasts a lot longer from around 1947 to around 1957. And you know, the Red Scare uses specific means of defamation. You know, it's othering. Everyone who dissents is a communist, they're an anarchist, they're a Jew, you know, like that's used as this big kind of thing to deport people. And so this is like the, you know, the Emma Goldman era for people who know, and you know, all of the stuff that's chronicled in the kind of early days of the FBI. As a side note, I always say this to my students, if you want to kind of get like a real succinct and not, it's kind of weird to say good, but an okay treatment of that era, the Leonardo DiCaprio film J. Edgar start kind of focuses there and is like a really interesting take on it. I wouldn't say it's particularly accurate, but it is entertaining, and it starts with the attack on Palmer's house and then the Palmer raids, which are the outgrowth of that. But anyway, you have this kind of first era of criminalization of dissent, so in the early part of the 20th century, and then it sort of, you know, it goes away for a tiny bit. Now again, the second Red Scare goes until about 1957. The COINTELPRO program, the counterintelligence program, which people are very familiar with, against the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement and others, sort of begins, according to records, in 1956 and goes till the early 1970s. So as the second Red Scare is ending, COINTELPRO is right there. So there is no real gap there. But COINTELPRO, you know, starts in 56 and ends in 71, but the methods are different. So whereas the first and second Red Scare is defame and deport, that's sort of its method, the COINTELPRO is sort of surveil and murder, right? It was a much more kind of mask off direct violence campaign. So you know, we have things like the murder of Fred Hampton in 1969, you know, in his bed. You know, it's a very famous image of, you know, this blood-soaked mattress in his room and bullet holes all throughout the walls. You know, this is a different era. This is the era where the state is more comfortable, at least on the superficial level, using kind of violence. And so when we kind of look at these different eras, we can see that they change. So again, that goes into the early 1970s. And then like the 80s and 90s kind of, you know, they occur, but they don't really see a ton of action. Now, mind you, I don't want to kind of not give adequate space to, for example, the massive repression against the queer liberation and AIDS advocacy movement that happened from groups like ACT UP. and a lot of the kind of queer liberation movements that happened. But it sort of falls outside of this in that they're more episodic. They're not as large scale, in part because the movement itself is not as large as like the civil rights movement and things like that. So then we kind of fast forward a little bit, and then we get into the era we're talking about. So we have the Red Scare first, COINTELPRO second, and then we kind of go into this era around the Green Scare, around this kind of 9/11 time. So, starts in the late 1990s and goes until the early 2010s. And then again, it sort of declines a little bit from, if we need to pick a date, we could say it declined from about 2008 to about 2017. Again, and then we have the kind of massive wave with anti-riot laws and anti-masking laws, and that's sort of where we ended with the last Trump administration. We have all of these state-based laws that are designed to sort of criminalize different forms of dissent. So what I would leave you with is the fact that, when we look at this, when we develop analytical frameworks to understand this, we need to think of them as on a continuum. These things range. There's a good framework that was put out by people who actually are colleagues of mine, so I know their work well, Lee Smithy and Lester Kurtz, about 10 years ago, and they developed this thing called the continuum of demobilization. And it's sort of a continuum that looks at a range of, tactics for repression, from overt violence, right, murdering people and executing them, all the way to kind of hegemonic discursive manipulation, right, changing the messaging, changing the way people think, things like that. So self-censorship to murder. And I think that's a really useful framework in understanding that we kind of always exist on this continuum of criminalization, and that we may kind of hop around from part to part, right? So in a particular moment, so again, looking at how the Gaza protests were policed, for example, we can see a combination of both hegemonic repression, soft repression, good protester, bad protester stuff, as well as overt violence. I mean, people saw the raids on Columbia with militarized SWAT vehicles and things like that, right? So there's no shortage of overt violence, but there's a lot of soft repression. And again, don't like that example? Look at the 2020 George Floyd uprising, right? You have massive police violence, you have some really horrific attacks on demonstrators, and then you also have soft forms of repression. To go back to the good protester, bad protester narrative, go back to these are all outside agitators coming from their trust funds because they're bored. Think of all the ways in which it was defamed. And then in the middle, you have all these other means. So I think that when we're trying to understand repression, when we're trying to understand how criminalization occurs, we need to understand it as running a gamut of different tactics and different strategies. We need to make sure that we're not confusing tactics with strategies. And we need to look for things, like censorship, defamation, disinformation, black propaganda, recuperation, right? Denying people employment, blacklisting people, like, we saw a lot in the 50s, and we definitely see a lot now. Selective facilitation, the idea that the state kind of picks a winner and try to helps that winner along and makes everyone else's life harder. In the anti-globalization era, we saw the rise of free speech zones. That was a bizarre method of repression. The use of mass surveillance, data mining, open source intelligence, social network analysis, everything on the tech side. FBI door knocks and home visits. We have restrictions of movement and things like no-fly lists. We have lawsuits and slap suits and arrests and prosecutions and grand juries and conspiracy charges, infiltration, false flags, agent provocateurs, mass incarceration, enhanced interrogation, physical violence, all the way up to counterinsurgency. And so when we discuss these things, I think it's important that we are not kind of stuck or what's that term? Pigeonholed into one particular area. And it really is a constellation of all of these methods. And they will kind of rise and fall at different times and largely based on our reaction. So if people want a way to be involved in this conversation, then react, right? When the state does something that you consider abhorrent, show that. But these are tests, right? The state tosses an idea out, and depending on the way people react, we'll either choose to do that tactic again, or we'll choose to change course. And that's really the ability that we have.
Wow. Thank you so much, Michael. That's such a helpful, so much helpful information. But the continuum framing, I think, is really, really great and a helpful grounding for conversations about repression in general, because it can get really easy to focus into the latest crisis of the day, which is important to respond to, as you said, but is not in isolation. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now for our repression in review segment, where we summarize publicly available info about a current site of struggle. In the last year of legal news from the movement to stop Cop City, we first have some updates on the case of the Atlanta 61. These are the 61 people indicted back in August 2023 under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. In January 2024, the one RICO defendant who had secured a speedy trial, Ayla King, got their proceedings put on hold after the judge denied their motion to dismiss. It wasn't until October that the Georgia Court of Appeals ruled and declared a mistrial. This puts them in good company with the remaining 60 defendants, who were supposed to be tried in small groups last year, but yeah, that didn't happen. Nobody's getting anything close to a speedy trial, and the holdup is largely because the prosecution doesn't have their shit together. They've repeatedly missed deadlines for submitting evidence and then had whole chunks of that evidence thrown out because some of it was totally irrelevant and some of it they'd gotten illegally. Then in September, the state was forced to drop the money laundering charges they'd handed three of the RICO defendants for literally being members of a bail fund. So the hopeful upshot of all of this is the prosecution's case is looking weaker by the minute, and the trial hasn't even begun, although everyone is still facing possible decades in prison. Meanwhile, the 61 aren't the only ones staring down serious time. In February, after some banks got smashed at a Stop Cop City summit in Tucson, three people were charged with a string of felonies. Also, in the first couple months of 2024, two people were charged in connection with two separate arsons of Cop City-related equipment. One of them was arrested in Charleston and faces federal charges for allegedly burning a Cop City contractor's trucks. The other, Jack Mazurek, was arrested in a multi-agency raid on his Atlanta home and charged with first-degree arson for allegedly burning Atlanta police motorcycles. In November 2024, they slapped him with an additional charge of felony drug possession for mushrooms they claimed to have found in his home way back during the February raid. In some better news, the longest-held RICO defendant, Indigenous Forest Defender Victor Puertas, was finally released after nearly a year behind bars. Also, Charleston anarchist Cypress Hartford was released from a federal grand jury subpoena in July after a two-month ordeal. By the time Cypress got her subpoena back in June, federal agents in Charleston had been intimidating suspected anarchists and handing out grand jury subpoenas for a while, possibly to help with their investigation of the struggle to stop Cop City in the area. Cypress writes, quote, "The feds saw the show of solidarity you displayed for me and chose not to test our resolve. When we reach out to each other, instead of isolating from each other, we have the power of community. Subpoenas can and must always be challenged. We can maintain a wall of silence that keeps all of us safer. We are stronger when none of us cooperate." End quote. Check the show notes for support info for some of the folks mentioned today. Thanks for listening to Outlaw. Stay tuned for our next episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Feel free to reach out to us with questions, ideas, topic proposals, or collaboration pitches at outlawpod@proton.me. Finally, thank you to Brass Tapestry for our theme music. Check out the full track, Tortuguita, wherever you get your music. There are a lot of self-righteous